In this weekend episode, three segments from this week's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN. First, a look at the campaign 2024 political landscape for both the White House and the Senate with Jacob Rubashkin, reporter and analyst for the political website Inside Elections. Then, 2024 Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson discusses her second run for the White House. And National Federation of Independent Business Vice President Kevin Kuhlman discusses the state of small business in America. Now, Inside Elections reporter and analyst Jacob Rubashkin talks about the race for the White House so far and the key Senate races to watch in 2024.
We're still 550 days away from Election Day 2024, and yet in the latest write-up by your colleague Nathan Gonzalez on InsideElections.com, he writes this: "It's not too early to talk about the presidential battlefield because the underlying political dynamics don't often shift dramatically in the months or even a year before the election." So what's the underlying political dynamics of the presidential race right now?
Well, we've got an incumbent Democratic president, Joe Biden, with middling approval ratings, seeking a second term, now officially having announced his reelection campaign. We've got a divided Congress facing a series of very important challenges over the next couple weeks even, and certainly over the next 18 months. And we have a former president in Donald Trump who is trying to come back into office, having announced his bid for president even before the 2022 midterm. So we know one side of the equation in President Biden. We have a good idea of the other side of the equation in Donald Trump. We know what the economy looks like, and we know the historical trends associated with presidential reelection bids over the last couple decades. So we have a pretty good idea of where things start out.
We saw President Biden's official rollout of his reelection. This is the Biden campaign ad that was put out this week.
"Too many people have been left behind and treated like they're invisible. Folks, my economic plan is about investing in places and people that have been forgotten. It's about making things here in America again. It's about good jobs. It's about the dignity of work. And it's about damn time we're doing it."
Joe Biden is determined to reward hard work. That's why he passed historic laws that rebuild our roads and bridges, invest in our factories, and bring back American manufacturing. Over 12 million jobs have been created. And Joe Biden's building an economy that leaves no city, no town, no American behind.
"We're investing in places and people that have been forgotten. They've been invisible, but we haven't forgotten. We're building an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, where no one's going to be left behind."
Joe Biden, a president for all Americans.
"I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message."
That was President Biden's rollout ad this week. How do you read that rollout and the media reaction to the rollout this week?
Well, he does a couple of interesting things. Firstly, in that ad, of course, leaning into the economy. This has been one of the major criticisms that the Republican Party has levied against Biden and the Democrats over the last 2 years. We saw the midterm environment on the Republican side being dominated by questions, particularly of cost of living, of inflation. So for Biden to come out of the gate on offense on the economy signals that he's really interested in taking this issue head on as he approaches his reelection bid, not ceding any of that ground to whoever his Republican opponent is. I think that the other ad that he released touched more on kind of the culture war issues and again went on offense on questions about book banning, on the January 6 attack on the Capitol, things like that. And so it was an aggressive launch. It was I would imagine, really a response to a lot of the criticism that's been out there of the president about the lack of high profile nature of his administration. And I think that his White House and his operation has heard that. And so even just by announcing their bid, right, they were putting to rest a lot of the speculation about whether he would indeed run again, right? He's the oldest person ever to serve as president. He would be 86 at the end of a second term. And as long as he's been elected, there has been this persistent kind of conversation, undertone about, oh, will he seek another term? Will he be a bridge candidate, like he said during the election, and only seek one term and allow for an open primary? And what this launch did more than anything else was say, no, he's in it for another term. He's in it with Vice President Harris for another term. That was very notable. It's Biden-Harris and all of the marketing and the branding. And so they really wanted to put an end to all that kind of speculation.
The other part of our conversation this morning is on the Senate battlefield in 2024, the main Senate races that will decide control of the upper chamber of that building behind me. Also, a new ad this week, again, 550 days away from Election Day. Republicans, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, targeting West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin. Here's that ad.
Joe Manchin wrote Biden's green energy bill, putting West Virginia jobs at risk, and bragged about it.
Do you regret voting for that massive spending bill?
No, not at all. As far as the Inflation Reduction Act, will be the most transformative bill that we've ever had.
Then his poll numbers tanked, so Manchin's changing his tune.
I would vote to repeal my own bill.
Manchin stood with Biden, not West Virginians. Tell Joe Manchin, we won't forget.
An ad from the National Republican Senatorial Committee targeting Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. How important is this seat or every seat this cycle?
Well, in a chamber as evenly divided as the Senate currently is, every seat is very important. Democrats, of course, sitting there with 50 seats, Republicans with 49 seats, and then independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona holding that final seat, does not caucus with either party. So every single seat for Republicans is one seat closer to getting the majority back. However, this West Virginia seat is probably the most important. If they can't win this one, it's highly unlikely that they can win back the majority, because West Virginia is such a Republican state. So at the moment, we see them really focusing on this state, really trying to almost get Manchin not even to run to begin with. They recruited the very popular incumbent governor to run against him. They are already starting to run TV ads against him and really signaling that this seat is their number one priority. It's their number one opportunity to help take back the Senate next year.
The fun thing about having inside elections on is that you make it very easy to try to get a sense of every race in every election. And it's insideelections.com that viewers can go. So I want to show two different aspects of the Senate ratings at Inside Election. It's the battleground seats. And you can see the battleground Democratic seats here. There's eight seats in this listing of battleground Democratic seats. If you go down to the battleground Republican seats, there's no seats listed in the Republican category. This is a campaign where Democrats are very much going to be on the defensive.
That's exactly right. Democrats have had three good cycles when it comes to this class of senators, right? Starting in 2006, really even starting in 2000, which we don't consider a great year for Democrats because of the presidential, but in fact, they actually picked up seats in the Senate. So starting in 2000, 2006, 2012, and 2018, all were good cycles for Senate Democrats, broadly speaking. And so what you ended up with was two-thirds of the seats up for election this cycle are held by Democrats. So naturally, they're going to be playing a lot more defense than offense. This year in particular, given the change in kind of the political landscape over the last couple of years, it's especially bad for them because they are defending quite a few seats in states that Donald Trump won either in 2016 or 2020. And we know that more than ever, the best way for determining how a state is going to vote for Senate is how they vote for president. So, you know, they are defending these seats in Republican states like West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, as well as battleground states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And they have very few, if any, pickup opportunities, right? The two that I'll mention here are Texas and Florida. And these are the two best opportunities Democrats have on this very meager map for them, right? And remember, we just saw a Republican senator in Florida win re-election by 16 points, a Republican governor in Florida win re-election by 20 points. Texas is not a Democratic state. It's not a state friendly to Democrats. So the fact that those are the best places that Democrats have to look, it really speaks to how difficult this cycle is for them when looking at offensive opportunities.
That was Jacob Rubashkin from the political website Inside Elections. Next, 2024 Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson discusses her candidacy and key issues in her campaign.
This is your second presidential bid. Why are you running?
I'm running because I feel that the United States needs to make an economic U-turn. You know, poll after poll shows that this country is moving in the wrong direction. That's the sense of the people, and the people are correct. And the whole, the radicalism, in a way, at the core of the American ideal is that the people direct things. And yet right now, things are being directed not so much by the people as by corporate donors and corporate huge entities of corporate wealth that actually determine our path. So the people need to step in there and turn things around.
Are you getting the people to support you financially?
Well, I am. I mean, you know, I'm in there. That's what a campaign is all about. You know, a campaign is a big job interview. It's a long job interview. And you are presenting yourself to the people. You're presenting your agenda. You're letting people know this is what I would do if I was given the job. And people think about it. Now, the problem we have right now, however, is that there are forces who seek to limit the voices that are actually presented to the people. This is why it's so important that the Democratic Party allow debate so that voters in the Democratic primary can recognize there are three candidates so far, and the American people should have as wide an array of options before them as possible.
What have you heard from the Democratic Party about debates?
Well, what I've heard from the Democratic Party about debates is what you and everybody else has heard, and that is that they don't plan to have any. They have simply decided that Joe Biden is the nominee. That's not democracy. A party that should be and has traditionally been such a champion of democracy itself should not be so wary of the democratic process in our own house.
So what is your strategy? Where are you right now in the country? And how do you plan to stay in this race,
well,
given that the party, as you said, wants Joe Biden?
The parties are not even mentioned in the Constitution. They are not the ultimate authority here. The people are the ultimate authority here. And I'm staying in the race because I'm talking to the people. A lot of that conversation with people these days, as you know, is online, TikTok, et cetera, various online platforms. But also there are those early primary states, New Hampshire, Michigan, Georgia, South Carolina, Nevada. You go out there. That's the American way. And that's what I'm participating in.
You're popular on TikTok. Explain your strategy there.
You know, it's interesting we use the word strategy, but look at Donald Trump when he won in 2016. Did he have a strategy or did he not just hit a nerve? I think that that's my main strategy, is telling truth. I think that I'm saying a lot of things that everybody says, but few people say them in public. Few people say them when the microphone is on. And that is that we are not at the moment functioning as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. You know, at the battlefield at Gettysburg, Lincoln said that the men who died, who were soldiers for the Union, had died on that battlefield, had given what he called their last full measure of devotion, so that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. It is perishing now. We are, for all intents and purposes, a government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. Our Congress is in many ways little more than a system of legalized bribery, where legislator after legislator, in the final analysis, does more to answer to the goals of their corporate donors than to the people of the United States. We have the safety, the well-being, the health of the American people at this point is almost secondary to the profit margins of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, big agricultural chemical companies, food companies, gun manufacturers, big oil and defense contractors. The people know this. We have 39% of the American people who now report that they skip meals in order to pay their rent. This is in the richest country in the world. And that number goes up to 44% among millennials. One third of Americans are living very economically unstable lives. One in four Americans are living with medical debt. We have the highest poverty rate, including the highest child poverty rate, of any country in the world. We have half of our seniors living on less than $25,000 a year. We have a third of our workers living on less than $15 an hour and not having a place to live. Things are not going well.
So what would you do?
Well, we have to have an economic U-turn in this country, as I said. We need to recognize that the rights that hold together a level of economic stability and the capacity of people to thrive that are granted to the citizens of every other advanced democracy should be granted to the American, such as universal health care, such as tuition-free college, which we had in this country until the 1960s, such as free child care, such as paid maternity and paternity leave, such as guaranteed sick pay and guaranteed livable wage. Those are the pillars. They should be seen as the main organs that provide people with the ability to thrive, not just survive an unjust economic system.
That platform sounds like President Biden's platform. He's tried it. Democrats have tried it.
Yeah.
How would you be different?
Well, President, I will certainly admit that if we had gotten Build Back Better, that would have been amazing. But we didn't get Build Back Better. And there are still things that the president could do. For instance, the president had said that we would have a raising of that minimum wage, which we haven't had in 13 years. As I said, a third of American workers live on less. Give me a break. So the president got it for federal workers. But then it came time to put it in a bill. And you know what stopped it? The parliamentarian. Now, truly, Greta, would the Republican Party ever allow themselves to be stopped by the parliamentarian? We allowed ourselves to be stopped by the parliamentarian because it was convenient to do so. The president has also approved the Willow Project. The president has given more oil drilling permits than even Trump did. The president is a nice man. This is not about who's not a nice man. But I have serious disagreements with the president about such fundamental things as whether or not we guarantee that this will be a habitable planet in 100 years.
That was 2024 Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. Next, a conversation about the state of small business in America with Kevin Kuhlman, Vice President of the National Federation of Independent Business.
It's National Small Business Week. So describe what it's like right now for small businesses post-pandemic.
Good morning, Greta. Thanks for having me today, and happy Small Business Week to the more than 33 million small businesses. National Federation of Independent Business, NFIB, is the nation's leading small business advocacy organization. We advocate on behalf of nearly 300,000 small business owner members in all 50 state capitals in Washington, D.C., and our guiding principle, our mission statement is to promote and protect the right of our small business owner members to own, operate, and grow their businesses. So it's great to be here this Small Business Week. Small businesses do face an uncertain future and have some economic challenges still coming out of the pandemic. Inflation and workforce shortages are a very close one in two of their top small business concerns. More than half of small business owners cannot fill open positions, although the good news is they are continuing to try to hire, even as larger businesses are shedding jobs. And inflation just kind of remains stubborn and pervasive, which makes everything within their supply chain more expensive and just their businesses overall more expensive and difficult to operate.
What about the issue of crime in downtown cities for small businesses? What impact is it having on them?
Certainly, downtown crime makes it harder for a small business to operate. As you see some larger retail stores close because of crime, that has a ripple effect on smaller businesses. More boarded up shops downtown mean fewer customers. And so there certainly is a ripple effect. And small business owners, it also increases their insurance costs as well. So there are some impacts, negative impacts of increased crime on small business owners.
What type of employees are these businesses looking for? And are there enough of them in this country?
It's a range. It's anything from skilled employees in the skilled in trades that are trying to, and certainly in construction, manufacturing, and those industries. But it's also just unskilled employees, those for entry-level positions as well. So it really ranges it, and it's kind of a mix of soft skills as well as those hard skills. Nearly half of small business owners cannot fill open positions. Of those that are trying to hire, almost all, more than 90%, are unable to find those qualified applicants. So it is small business owners are finding where are the workers and what can they do to try to attract and retain employees. They are increasing wages. They are increasing benefits. They are taking on the training themselves, insourcing all of that and creating a training program, as well as not requiring as high of standards as they may be used to, maybe a certificate as opposed to a degree. But they're really doing everything they can to try to attract and retain qualified employees. It's just extremely difficult.
What is the percentage of small businesses that employ teenagers? And are there policy issues around employing the youth of this country?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the exact percentage, but I do know that at many locations, you just see help wanted all positions. So there certainly are opportunities for teenagers. And I think small business owners would be more willing to take on less skilled, younger employees. Now, when it's a very competitive market, right? You have to pay a competitive wage for your local economy. There are other localities that are requiring higher minimum wage thresholds. And you certainly need whatever employee you do employ to be productive enough to justify that. But like I said, many business owners are taking on the training themselves. They'd be more than willing to take on a teenager who's willing to show up on time, who's willing to learn and contribute. They're very open to something like that.
Let's talk about the minimum wage. Senator Bernie Sanders, who's been advocating for a higher minimum wage, he'll be talking about it on Capitol Hill today. What's happening on a state level?
Different states and localities are moving at different thresholds. I know in certain states like New York, California, Massachusetts, they're pushing ahead for even higher than $15 per hour. Here in D.C., it's certainly higher than that. I think it's around $16.50 with another step up in July. This does make operating costs more expensive. It means business owners must become more productive. It's another challenge. It's another variable for small business owners at this point in time. Our members are generally against substantial increases to the minimum wage. You do see proposals of $20 or more per hour. That would be extremely difficult during these economic conditions. Instead, we believe that the local economic conditions are what should drive the minimum wage. And in many cases, because business owners are competing for those employees, it is above the federal standard and in many state standards in where it does exist.
That was Kevin Kuhlman of the National Federation of Independent Business. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.